From WNYC, New York Public Radio, this is the Leonard Lopate Show. I'm Leonard Lopate, and this is just one segment of our show, but every interview is available on demand at WNYC.org. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
WNYC podcasts are supported by Holy Name Hospital in Teaneck, New Jersey, providing comprehensive centers in cardiovascular services, interventional radiology, and cancer care. More information at www.holyname.org.
I'm Jonathan Capehart, here today for Leonard Lopate, and this is WNYC AM, FM, and WNYC.org. In the decades before the sexual revolution that made Roe v. Wade possible, there were many young women who were forced by parents and social workers to give up their children for adoption. Anne Fessler's The Girls Who Went Away uncovers this secret history of women who, feeling society gave them no other choice, surrendered babies for adoption. This is a haunting collection of stories about sorrow and loss by mothers who've largely kept their stories locked away inside. The book is published by Penguin, and I'm pleased it brings Anne to the show today. Anne, thank you very much for coming.
Thank you.
This book focuses on the mothers who gave away their children, but much of your visual art has focused on the adoptee's perspective. How did you come to shift the perspective to that of the birth mother?
I began working with my own story as an adoptee. And through exhibiting the work that I created, I kept coming in contact with mothers who'd surrendered and other people also from the adoption community. But I was so struck by the stories of the women who surrendered that I decided that I wanted to make that the focus of the work.
Mm-hmm. And how did you find so many birth mothers? Weren't there 100 or more that you wanted to interview or that you did interview for this
That
book?
I did interview. There were many more that were willing to be interviewed, but I got to as many as I could before the deadline for the book. So one way that I found mothers was that as I would go around and speak about the other work I had done, short films and installations on the subject of adoption, people would come forward afterwards from the audience, and they would say, my mother or my aunt or a friend of mine from college, and I would say, well, I'm starting to interview these or collect these oral histories on tape, and please ask them if they would like to be interviewed. I also had hundreds and hundreds of people write me after having articles published in the paper, the Boston Globe and the Providence Journal, about the project, about the collecting of the oral histories. And anytime something like that was published, I would get many hundreds of emails of people saying, this happened to me, I'm one of those women. I would be willing to be interviewed.
Now, many of these women were telling their stories for the first time, correct?
That's right. Some of them were, yeah.
And so you recorded them, and actually we have a few of their stories.
My parents were not happy about it. My parents are Holocaust survivors. I was raised very strictly. My daddy called me a whore.
My parents' generation, that greatest generation, that's what they thought. It didn't happen to nice girls, but nice girls do get pregnant.
Sex was never discussed in those days.
The book describes very ordinary teenage behavior that had very serious consequences. Was sexual education taught in schools back then?
No.
Sort of a softball question here.
No. I mean, I grew up in the 50s and the 60s, and so I'm the same age as many of the women I interviewed, actually. And I can say no. Sex education was watching a scratchy movie with, you know, about egg and sperm meeting, and there was no discussion of where that actual meeting place was. And so many of the women who became pregnant really did not understand that they were even vulnerable.
Did they even know about contraceptives? How did they find out about them, if at all?
Basically, they relied on their boyfriends who told them, I will not get you pregnant. Yes, that's really. They were learning from their boyfriends because they did not have any information about sex or pregnancy prevention from either schools or their parents. And so, the young man that they were involved with would basically say, I won't get you pregnant. Mm-hmm. And they believed it.
Now, clearly contraception was available, but was it available to teens?
No. Some of these laws are state by state. It wasn't until 1974 that it was that contraceptive devices were available to unmarried people across the nation. Before that time, some state laws prevented young people from, even boys, from buying condoms. And they were generally kept behind the counter at the pharmacy. And, you know, in some towns, just going in and asking for one would mean the pharmacist might call the boy's parents. It's not like they were hanging out on the counters at the grocery stores in those days. You really, you know. And so a lot of times, I guess, boys would ask older boys to buy them and, you know. So, no, they were not available.
Now, you discussed the sexual double standard of the pre-Roe era, in which good girls were not supposed to know anything about birth control or to express sexual desire, but good girls did have sexual desires and were having sex. So who were these good girls?
Well, there is no distinction I would want to make between good girls and bad girls. At the time, the sexual standard was incredibly hypocritical in that people lied about their sexual activity. And so if a young woman was having sexual relations, she lied about it and she expected her boyfriend to keep the secret. But once somebody became pregnant and it was obvious that they had sex, they became the focus of all the gossip, and they were considered bad girls. They were considered promiscuous. But in fact, by the late 60s, something like 68% of women were having sex before they exited their teen years. So certainly premarital sex was widespread. It was more common than not.
I'm Jonathan Capehart, sitting in for Leonard Lopate, and you're listening to WNYC AM, FM, and WNYC.org. I'm sitting here talking with Anne Fessler, who is the author of The Girls Who Went Away. And you've written that the desire for respectability by the white middle class, by white middle class families, trumped everything else. They were willing to give away their grandchildren to keep their shame hidden. But it was different for African-American teenage girls. How so?
The surrender rate of African-American teenage girls was something like 1.5%, unmarried teenage girls, compared to a range from 20 to up to 40% for middle-class white girls.
Mm-hmm. And why was that?
Well, I think in many of these families of the women I interviewed, the families had just gained a lot of economic and social status. This was the post-war era. There was an enormous economic boom, and that economic boom was not equally felt among African-American and white families. And among the white families that had been had benefited from that boom, those families definitely did not want to slip backwards. And having a pregnant teenage daughter was considered low class. And so they couldn't let anybody in their social circle know that they had a pregnant daughter, so they had to get the daughters out of town as quickly as possible.
And I was about to ask, where did they go?
Well, a fairly sizable number went to maternity homes. So there were over 200 maternity homes around the country that took care of the young women during their pregnancy. But some went to relatives' houses in different towns, as long as they were kept out of sight. Some actually hid in their own homes. The families kept them hidden away in their own homes. But usually they were sent out of town, either to a maternity home or to a relative.
The whole thing is just so heartbreaking. What were those maternity homes like?
Well, they were like gigantic dorms in one way. The girls were housed, and in some cases they were so overcrowded that girls had to wait until their seventh month to even get into the home, and had to be taken care of in a wage home before that, where they took care of a family and took care of a family's children, babysat, lived in a home of a nearby couple, and then they were sent over to the home in their seventh month. In the home, they had daily chores to do, and they had sort of arts and crafts and things like that to occupy the women's time, but they rarely spent any time talking about childbirth or giving the women education into what was to come, was inevitable.
Right.
But I guess they didn't want to scare them. I'm not really sure, but but they really did not. I don't think any of the women that I interviewed, I don't think even one was given a good sense of what was to come or prepared for childbirth, labor and childbirth.
So they weren't actually, they weren't prepared for the actual birth.
No.
If I remember correctly, there's some women who just went in, they had no idea what was going on.
No.
Some of them didn't even know they were pregnant, didn't know how it happened.
Well, yeah, they, I think they had figured that out by the time,
oh, by the time they're there. They figured they were pregnant.
But, yeah, but they... But they did not really know too much. One woman tells an incredible story about the day before she's going to leave home and go away to the maternity home, and she says to her mother, "How do they take how do they take care of the mark when the baby comes out?" Because she didn't know how babies came out. I mean, how they were born, how they came out of your body. And so she didn't understand, because she said, "I'd seen lots of women on beaches and I could never tell if they had a baby or not." And her mother says, "Oh my God, Nancy, that baby comes out the same way it went in." And she's aghast. She has no idea. And again, you know, at the maternity homes, they really did not talk about labor, labor or delivery. So they really had, they were very much alone. They were not allowed to have their family there with them.
Mm-hmm.
How
much time did they have with the baby?
Well, that varied quite a bit. There were some, in some cases, they were not allowed to even see their baby. And in other cases, they were able to spend days or even weeks with their child.
Let's hear some more of the voices from your book, The Girls Who Went Away.
They drove her in this little cart, and they put her in my arms, and I looked down into that little face. I thought I loved my mother. I thought I loved my friends. I thought I loved Mick Jagger. This was something else.
The nurse came in with this little pink bundle. The minute that the nurse puts the baby in your arms, everything changes.
There is such a difference between an unwanted pregnancy and a baby.
There's a difference between an unwanted pregnancy and a baby.
Absolutely. And that's what a lot of these women discovered late in their pregnancy or after they gave birth. And at that point, it was very difficult to reverse this process. They felt like they were, you know, on a conveyor belt, and the plan was made, and they're moving down this track. And at that point, they see the child, they meet the child, they really understand this is their child. And at that point, there's kind of no way of going back.
Right, I was about to ask, was there any way for them to change their mind at all?
Well, legally, yes, but nobody informed them that they legally could change their minds.
And there's no one to advise them, no one to tell them what their rights were.
No, I didn't talk to one woman that had any kind of legal representation or even an impartial advocate that could let them know what their rights were. These are state-by-state rights, so they're different in every state. Or that could give them information about what they may have been entitled to. Many of them did not even know they could have sued for paternity. You know, they could have collected money from the father, or that they could have been eligible for certain kinds of government programs that would have given them temporary assistance while the baby was young, you know, so that they could, you know, gradually go back to work and so forth. But they had no idea. They're these middle class white girls mostly. They didn't even know what welfare was.
You know, back then it was such a judgmental time. Mm-hmm. Everyone you talked to, from the parents to the teachers, the social workers, members of the clergy, even the hospital staffs, the nurses and the doctors, everyone passed judgment on them. So was it even possible for a young woman to turn to anyone who would advocate on her behalf?
I believe that unless the family felt that they were willing to help out, let that young woman or let the couple come home and stay with them until they could get on their feet, and, you know, unless that happened, they really didn't have anyone to turn to. Now, of course, I'm only interviewing the women who ultimately surrendered. Obviously, some people were able to get some kind of support and work this out through family or, you know, in some other way, because not everybody surrendered. Mm-hmm. But in fact, in these families, that was the case. The family would, the parents would not come to their rescue, would not let them come back home with the child, would not give them any kind of temporary assistance. And so they really were left with no other choice. They didn't really ever make a choice that was made for them.
There is an overwhelming sense of shame.
Absolutely.
Involved in all this.
Absolutely.
That just sort of enveloped and just hung over everything. How did that affect the women you interviewed or even their families, their parents?
Well, that's very interesting because, you know, everybody's familiar with the everybody over 50 certainly familiar with the shame of, you know, getting caught, getting pregnant at that period of time. In the long run, the shame for them has not been about pregnancy. The shame for them has been about not fighting hard enough to keep their child. And that's how many of these women have felt since, especially since their time of being pregnant and the conditions of that time really changed shortly afterwards. So here they are being told, you must have a husband. You're unfit because you're not married. You can't raise a child on your own. If you love this child, you must give it to, you know, a couple so the child will have a mother and a father. And within a short period of time, women are standing up and saying, I'm keeping my child. There are so many divorces that many children are being raised by single mothers anyway. So the entire, you know, cultural climate changed around them, and now they're angry because mm-hmm. they're saying, people said I could not do it. It was impossible, and now I see everyone else doing it.
Right. They were told to, you know, forget about it,
yes,
move on. You're better. The baby's better without you.
Yes, exactly. And that really affected their sense of motherhood and parenting. And as a matter of fact, 30% of the women I interviewed never had another child.
Well, out of choice, or I understand some women surgically made it impossible for them
yes.
to have children.
And it was in a way a kind of, you know, self-punishment. But I mean, they were really told over and over that they were unfit to be a mother. And so when all the authority figures in your life, when you're young and impressionable, are telling you you cannot be a good mother, you're unfit. And then, you know, even if you are married, you're still the same person. And many of them mentioned that. They said, well, I'm still the same person I was. So if I wasn't, you know, if I couldn't be a good mother a couple years ago, I'm the same person. Why would I be a good mother now? And so, four of the women I interviewed surgically ended their ability to have children through having, you know, tubal ligations. And many of the other ones just simply felt that they were either unworthy or it would be a kind of insult to the child they surrendered, because why would they keep another child if they had given that child up?
Wow. I mean, this is such an intense book and an intense discussion and an intense subject. How did these women go about rebuilding their lives?
A lot of them had very bad experiences initially, in the sense that in some cases, not all, but they hooked up with some kind of bad characters because they felt, you know, they felt pretty bad about themselves, and they didn't think they deserved a normal guy. After all, they had been a really bad girl, and they had done something really bad, and so very often they sort of got into bad relationships. Some of them drank a little too much. They talk about going to college and being drunk and crying, and people saying, you know, why are you so sad all the time? So many of them had an initial 10-year period that was pretty rough. Mm-hmm. And then in some cases, many of these women have gone back to school at age 50 to finish their college educations because their entire life was disrupted by this. You know, they didn't drop out of school. Many of them finished high school at these maternity homes, but many of the parents who would have been willing to help them go to college were basically, you know, we spent a lot of money on the maternity home. That's your college education, or that's your wedding dress, or whatever. They really withheld afterwards.
I'm speaking with Ann Fessler, author of the book The Girls Who Went Away. We're going to take a quick break, but stay with me for more, and we'll hear more voices of the girls who went away. I'm Jonathan Capehart here today for Leonard Lopate, and this is WNYC AM FM and WNYC.org. I'm sitting here with Ann Fessler, author of The Girls Who Went Away. We were just speaking about how traumatic the experience of giving up their child was. This clip really illustrates this vividly.
And we get out of the hospital. My dad got in the driver's seat. My mom got in the passenger side. I got in the back seat. And looking out that back window, that view of the hospital getting smaller and smaller, I flipped out. It was total 100% ripped terror, wailing, screaming, crying, and nobody said a word. My mother didn't even turn around.
And Ann Fessler. I mean, families didn't talk about this.
No.
I think also her mother didn't turn around or say a word, but her father behind the wheel.
Yeah,
she said he turned white knuckled. White knuckled.
Yeah, yeah. He's the rest of that story is that she said her father was like a statue driving the car up there, white knuckled and just moving forward. And that was very typical. Young women went back home with their families, and essentially it was to never. The family didn't want it ever talked about again. It was like, this is over. You're going back to your old life. You know, we paid a lot of money to send you away and have this, you know, out of our life, and that's it. And in most families, it was never, ever talked about again. No one said to the young woman, how do you feel? You know, do you miss your baby? Nothing. It was just silence.
What kind of relationship did these girls have with their parents?
Well, up until that time, in most cases, it was a pretty good relationship. After that time, in many cases, that was the end of the old relationship.
Mm-hmm. And how did those parents feel now? I mean, they gave up a grandchild.
Well, at the time, I think they just felt it was the best thing to do for their daughter, and certainly for themselves. Mm-hmm. But many of the parents over time have felt differently. They came to feel differently, I should say. They later, as everything changed around them, they've apologized to their daughters for making mm-hmm. them surrender.
Well, given your own background, what was it like researching this book?
What can I say? I had, as an adoptee, I had, you know, a good experience as an adoptee. But I also, as I was growing up, very much empathized with my mother's situation, knowing the stigma attached to unwed pregnancy at the time, knowing how painful that must have been for her to kind of go through this, being sent away, you know, going to a maternity home. And so I always felt a great deal of empathy for her. And I gradually was able to learn a little bit about her, but I did not contact her right away. In part, that was because, and this is a very common story, I think adoptees are trying to protect their adoptive parents. My mother herself was adopted. My adoptive mother was herself adopted. Wow. So I come from a long line of adoptees. And even though she was very, very open about my brother and I and our status as adoptees, and she would always talk about how she couldn't wait to bring us home and that sort of thing. It was always presented very much in a very open and honest way. She felt that I should not look into anything about my natural mother.
You found your birth mother, mm-hmm. But you waited 14 years to find her?
To contact her.
You yeah. found her, but you didn't contact
yeah,
her.
Yeah, I knew where she was, yeah.
And I also understand the adoption agency lied.
Well, that what they lied about, adoption agencies very often provided a kind of trumped-up version of who the adopting family was. They used to tell people, tell the young women that their son or daughter was going to a doctor and his wife, and the wife was a stay-at-home mom. I mean, they would paint this picture that made it, you know, it was very hard to compete with that, right, as a young woman.
The Cleavers.
Yeah, exactly. And so they had told my mother that my mother was a nurse and my father owned a factory. And she thought that sounded, you know, pretty good, that, you know, they made them sound much wealthier than they were. I mean, I was raised in a sort of working class, middle class family, and that was not true. My mother was a nurse, but, you know, she was a practical nurse. She had 2 years training. My father definitely did not own a factory.
Mm-hmm. Now, you were not given to your adoptive parents for 3 months.
Yeah, that was common. I was born in 1949. And in the late 40s and 50s, it was actually quite common, even in some cases into the 60s, for a child who was going to be adopted to be in a kind of holding pattern for 2 to 3 months. And my understanding of that is that in some cases that was certain childhood diseases could not be identified. But families did not take home newborns in that period of time.
But your birth mother thought you had gone directly to your adoptive parents.
That's right. She was told that I would go right away. And so that was the other thing that they, you know, sort of lied about, yeah. Mm.
Was it a deliberate choice not to focus on the stories of the adoptive parents?
My interest was, I didn't really hear my first story directly from the mouth of a woman who had surrendered a baby until I was 40 years old. And I'm an adoptee, so this is part of my story. And I was quite shocked, you know, when I heard the story from her perspective, and I just felt this is the part that nobody hears. We always hear, you know, about the joys of adoption from adoptive families. And, you know, you hear something about adoptees, but you never hear these stories. And I thought I consider myself a person who is fairly up to speed on issues dealing with women's rights and women's lives. And here I am, an adoptee, and I still had never heard one of these stories. And so from the first moment that I heard the story, as I said before, I started, you know, paying attention to more stories to make sure that wasn't just an odd case, right? And it turned out that the more stories I listened to, the more stories I heard, they were all very similar. And so I just really felt that these were the stories that were hidden, and these were the stories that people needed to understand. And in part because also doing work about adoption, I ran into many adoptees who said they had felt thrown away, that they didn't understand why they were given away. It made them feel really terrible, thinking their own mother sort of cast them mm-hmm. aside and didn't want to parent them. And they didn't understand that the situation was so much more complex than that. And they didn't understand that it may not even have been a choice on her part. Hardly anyone I interviewed, a few people participated in the decision, and based on the few options available, mm-hmm. they chose that option. But for the vast majority of the women I interviewed, there never was another option presented, so they didn't make a decision.
Right. So there's no sympathy whatsoever for the birth mother.
No.
None.
No.
You know, this it's an odd. That was an odd time because the unmarried woman who got pregnant was judged.
Yes.
But then the married woman who couldn't get pregnant was judged.
Yes, that's true.
You know, is there any equally painful story here of the adoptive parents' struggles to have their own children?
I did not interview any adoptive parents. I only interviewed mothers who had surrendered, so I have not mm-hmm. collected their stories.
Mm-hmm. I'm Jonathan Capehart here today for Leonard Lopate, and this is WNYC AM, FM, and WNYC.org. I'm sitting here with Ann Fessler, the author of The Girls Who Went Away, a book of the stories of the women from World War II to pre-Roe versus Wade?
1945 to 1973, so it's bound on each end by the end of World War II to when Roe v. Wade was essentially made.
And this is the story of women who became unwed mothers who became pregnant mm-hmm. And who were sent away, who right. went away to have their children.
Right.
And it's the stories here are heartrending and painful. And we heard some of the voices before. How many women actually sought out their children?
More than half of the women I interviewed have looked for their children and had some sort of a reunion. And whether that's just a couple of meetings or whether it's grown into a very close relationship, it varies from person to person. The vast majority have been very positive.
What was your adopted parents' attitude towards you searching for your birth mother?
Yeah, my mother was not keen on the idea. I think it was potentially a little threatening to her as an adoptive mom that, you know, I might hook up with my so-called, you know, my real mother, and mm-hmm. therefore, like, not have any use for her anymore or something. But, it was an ungrounded fear.
And we have a call from Flynn in Brooklyn. He met his mother, his birth mother, 3 years ago. Flynn?
Yes.
You're on with Ann Fessler.
Hello.
Hi, Ann. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm great. It's a pleasure to hear these topics being talked about.
So you met your mother?
Yes. About 4 years ago, I flew down to Tampa on Mother's Day. We had news crews and everything, and
oh my goodness,
it was pretty wild.
And so, have you stayed in touch since?
My half brother Tom has actually moved up here with me.
Wow.
He's living with me now.
Uh huh.
So that was
a great guy. He's a great guy. We get along great.
Was it the initial reunion? Was it good from the start, or was there an adjustment?
It was fantastic. She sent me an email. I registered on a website at one point, and she found it. And luckily, I had the same email address. I get this email at 2:00 in the morning saying "birth mother." I was like, "You got to be kidding me!" And I called her the next day, and the first words out of her mouth were, "I'm sorry."
Oh.
And I had to immediately say, don't apologize. Don't ever apologize, because it was the best thing you ever did.
Wow. And do you have any half-siblings?
I do. I have three, but I don't know that I'll ever get to meet them.
Flynn, you said your half-brother Tom is up there with you. Is there much of an age difference?
6 years.
Who's older?
I am.
Yes,
I always wanted to have a little brother, so it's kind of fun to have somebody to pick on.
And has the internet changed the ability of adoptees to find their mothers?
Absolutely, it's made an enormous difference. There's hundreds and hundreds of sites that are sort of people, you know, winging it and setting up sites and setting up places to facilitate reunions. There are also official registries that people run. In addition, there are registries states run registries, and some of the old maternity home organizations that have morphed into new organizations now help people reunite. And there's a large nonprofit registry called the Soundex International Reunion Registry that is a mutual consent registry. So if the two people each send in their names and the amount of information that they do have, if they believe they have a match, they contact each party.
Flynn, thank you very much for calling and for sharing sharing your story with us. And you write about many of these mothers wanting to remain anonymous because they haven't told anyone, even up to today, about the children they gave away.
Is it still
Shame, or is it a need for privacy? What do you think is motivating that?
I think the shame was ingrained so deeply in these women, and it affected their life so dramatically that even though in every other part of their life they're very forthright, and many are very accomplished and have doctorate degrees, in this one. On this one issue, though, it's still extremely difficult for them to admit. They were told by every authority figure in their life that they were, that they had ruined their family, that this was a horrible, horrible thing that they had done, and to keep their secret and not tell anyone. And during this period of time, they were advised, by clergy and everyone else, don't ever tell. Later, if you get married, don't ever tell your husband, because he'll think you're used merchandise. And so, this was instilled. Don't tell. You're bad. You don't want anybody to know this about you. And so even for women who are very out about everything else and accomplished, like I said, many of them still have a very hard time talking about this. And in some cases, they told a husband right before they married, but they've never told their children.
One of the stories told was a woman, a businesswoman in New Hampshire or Maine?
New Hampshire.
In New Hampshire, who gave her child up for adoption. And then she said that child drove her.
Absolutely. All her life.
Tell her story real fast.
She felt that And she, along with many other women, felt, I'm going to find a way to meet this child one day. I know we're going to meet again. It's not the end. You know, this is a temporary, long-term, temporary separation, but I am going to meet this child one day. And she says, I wanted her to be proud of me when we meet. And so she was very driven as a businesswoman and wanted to accomplish a lot in her life. So when she eventually met her daughter would be able to be proud of her.
Right. She said she didn't want her daughter to find her and not have her be the best,
absolutely,
most successful person.
Woman on this earth, she says. Yes, exactly.
Yeah. Your book seems to be making the case for more transparency in the adoption process.
Yeah. Absolutely. I think that the idea of families or institutions building policy based on secrecy and lies does not make any sense to me. So both, you know, the adoption industry in general is more open today, but still most state laws prevent or at least throw a lot of roadblocks in the way of people being able to reunite. So it's impossible in many states for an adoptee to get a copy of their original birth certificate, for example. So even if you don't necessarily want to reunite, you can't even know what your original family name was. You don't know anything about your family history. You don't even know what nationality you are. And so adoptees are the only, you know, citizens that are denied the ability to know those basic things about themselves.
Mm-hmm. Ann Fessler, she is the author of The Girls Who Went Away, an incredible book about women who gave up their children for adoption in the years between World War II and pre-Roe versus Wade. It's a book published by Penguin. Thank you so much, Ann, for being here.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to The Leonard Lopate Show from WNYC New York Public Radio. You can hear everything we do and check out our other podcasts at WNYC.org or on iTunes. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.